Forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special episode of Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined today by Chris Morgan.
Hey guys.
And the venerable Gav Thorpe.
Hello.
Gav, thanks again for coming on the show with us. It means a lot for you to take time out for us.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Now, this is a rare event for us anyway. You're hot off of appearing at Black Library Live yesterday.
Yes, Black Library Live and live on Twitch as well, actually, as part of that. That was entertaining.
Seeing all the coverage from that has just been amazing. I mean, there seems like so much info that wasn't just novel-related got talked about and spoiled in pictures and stuff from that event.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's... there's been obviously just as part of Games Workshop in general, but with Black Library in particular as well, an opening up again of that kind of communication of what's coming out and where different series are going and, like I say, sharing the art and the covers and things. So, and it certainly makes it easier for us as authors when we're at the events and we can talk about stuff because, of course, our timelines are very different. You know, things like Azrael's coming out now, but I finished working on that 6 months ago. So actually being able to talk about what I'm writing at the moment is definitely helpful.
I bet people are just eating that up.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's nice, you know, both with the seminars, but also just sort of like in the signings and things, just having, you know, people get to ask, you know, one or two questions when you're chatting to them and being able to be open about what's going on and what your plans are and things like that means that they take away more from the event as well. It's not just being sort of like escorted around a retail stand and then kicked out the door. There's actually... being at the event itself and having that opportunity to ask the questions and to see the stuff being revealed sort of thing is one of the benefits of attendance. And obviously, like I say, everything ends up on the internet within 3 minutes, but it's still not quite the same as, you know, or sooner, yeah. It's still not quite the same as being there. And like I said, and actually being able to interact as well with an author or with editors or the artists and things and ask them what you might, you know, because... somebody else might not ask the questions you want to ask.
We can go ahead and talk, if you don't mind, about Azrael. It's up for order on the blacklibrary.com site right now.
That's right, yes. The special edition or limited edition is now available to order. It was available for sale yesterday. I'm not sure it's actually sending them out yet. And it seemed to be very popular. I think pretty much everyone I signed stuff for had a copy. I was both surprised and delighted. And that it seemed to be one of the acquisitions of the day for a lot of people, actually. And people being very positive about the Legacy of Caliban, you know, sort of the omnibus came out of that recently and things. So people keen to see more Dark Angel stuff. And the Azrael book itself is very nice.
I'm going to ask a question now that you probably can't answer, and I apologize. But so if there's like a silence here for the listeners, just know that I cut it out. Well, now that you spent a lot of time with the Dark Angels, was Luther wrong?
Was Luther wrong? Oh, that's a really deep question. And one I've not finished exploring, I suppose, because I'm still writing heresy stuff. One of the things I've always tried to do, and although it kind of swings backwards and forwards, whenever I've been writing, from when I did Angels of Darkness... and I did like the Testimony of Astolan and the Interrogation of Boreast and the Two Points of View. And as much as Astolan is now obvious lied during a lot of that and things, and various revelations that have come to light, I don't think I've ever tried to take a side. And I don't, because I like to write generally about perspectives, whether it's the Eldar or the Dark Angel stuff and things, which is because all of reality is kind of coloured by your perspective. So is Luther right? Absolutely. He had some good reasons to do what he did. If you look at what happened to Caliban, the way the lion treated him, all that sort of thing, then he's justified. But that's not necessarily the same as right. And one of the things I did in Angels of Caliban, and there's a little bit of it actually in Azrael, was look at the notions of like loyalty and honour. That was kind of a bit of a tagline in my head and what that means to people. So when it comes to... I suppose when it came to writing Azrael, it was the book itself set. It's not set in the end of the 41st millennium, like the Legacy of Caliban. It goes back to literally the moment when Azrael takes over as Supreme Grand Master.
I think that's one of the coolest things about the Dark Angels, though, is that the people do have that same, or at least a similar perspective, and it's attractive. I mean, the whole, it gives them their mystique, gives them some character and stuff. I mean, I apologize. I really wasn't trying to put you on the spot. I just was curious as to what might say.
Yeah. I mean, it's, that's it. And it's one of the things that has got a very real continuity in terms of that perspective from the Horus Heresy all the way through to the present day, and it's coloured everything that the Dark Angels have done and achieved, and the decisions they've had to make. And so Azrael, it's an exploration almost of that decision-making process. He's at the start, you know, the opening line pretty much almost of the book is him learning that his predecessor, Supreme Grandmaster Nibirius, has died. And it's literally because he's Grand Master of the Deathwing, he has to take over in the middle of a campaign. So whilst handling that side of things, also ascending to be the spiritual lord of the Unforgiven, and all kinds of other stuff. But I've kind of couched it as an Arthurian quest, really. That's what I had in mind, because there's a lot of that sort of mythology and that imagery kind of goes into the Dark Angels, as well as the secretive sort of, Knights Templar and all that sort of thing. Actually, the Arthurian, the idea of the hunt as this kind of perhaps almost impossible grail quest and things is one of the things that underpins a lot of their concept. So it was good fun actually to play around with Azrael as this sort of like knight errant almost of going out on this quest to become the new king of the Dark Angels kind of thing.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting that you make the comparison between the Templar, because I was just thinking something along that same lines. I mean, there's a lot of that sort of fiction around here about the mystery of the Knights Templar and secret societies and things like that, and how that relates to the Dark Angels in 40K is very interesting. Now, I wanted to ask you a question since we're talking about Azrael. On your website, the gavthorpe.co.uk, you have a post on here about the playlist that you were listening to while writing the book. And I've never seen an author put one of these up before, so it's very, very interesting to me. Can you explain a little bit about the choices for your music selections or the things that you feel set the mood?
Yeah, I mean, there's one very basic criteria of the music I listen to while I'm literally at the keyboard typing, which is it cannot have lyrics that I understand, because I end up listening to or even if I'm not listening to the words end up creeping into your consciousness and end up on the page in a weird way. So it's either stuff that's purely instrumental or stuff that's like, you know, if it's like got Latin chanting or, you know, it's Gregorian chants and that sort of stuff. You don't really think of it in the same way, so it doesn't quite enter your head. And then there's usually two parts to every playlist, or two kind of themes, I suppose. One of which is because 40K or Black Library fiction tends to be action orientated.
there's a little bit of violence in there here and there, isn't there?
There's always a kind of a spine of fairly action orientated music, which, you know. I mean, my fallbacks are always like the Mad Max Fury Road soundtrack, which is just this blistering, pulsing kind of cacophony of awesomeness.
That's a good one.
And things like that, the Dread soundtrack and lots of there's quite a few soundtracks and game soundtracks and stuff that depend, you know, there's subtleties of like which one I might choose over another, but usually it's just like there's a core of four or five that might end up in most of my playlists. But the rest of it's atmosphere. So for something like Azrael, and trying to get more of that medieval feel and stuff like that, a lot of the stuff I go to is kind of classical. So there's you know, I've got a particular version of Wagner's Ring Cycle, which is without words. So it doesn't have all the over-the-top bombastic Teutonic opera. It's just got the awesome music, you know. And then another stuff, which is for Azrael, for instance, I went back and actually got some albums which were medieval inspired or medieval, actually, you know, played on medieval style instruments and things like that, so that on some of the other some of the scenes that aren't the action orientated, that they there's a bit more atmosphere going on, and the thing is, I just, when I play it, it's actually all just random, and you know, I don't put on a particular track when I've got to write a particular scene. Sometimes I might skip one.
Okay.
It's not quite appropriate. It's like I'm in a scene and actually I really don't need this pulse pounding theme tune going on at the moment when I'm trying to have this in-depth conversation between these two characters. So I'll hit the skip button. But actually the rest of it's just kind of this melange of the tracks sort of going on in the background. And it's good. I've had people, even yesterday, but also, you know, online and things say that they quite enjoy actually listening to those tracks while they're reading it, as well as people who've said, you know, oh well, that's great, I've stolen that and added that to my playlist for when I'm writing and things like that. So it's sort of a dual purpose, I suppose, or you know, things that people might have on background music for when they're playing Dark Angels, for instance. You know, just you can music influences us in ways we don't really understand a lot of the time. And it's just cool to have and swap ideas about things that influence and inspire us.
Being a fan of this genre, as well as a great contributor, when you see these limited edition things come together like Azrael, are you just totally blown away? Because you get to see all the concept art before it goes live, right? In most cases.
Oh, quite often, yeah. Usually we'll get to see the covers and things like that. I mean, it's interesting because when you get something packaged up, which just turns words into an artifact, you know, obviously the story is still kind of key, but actually having the book itself and the presentation of it, and you look at things like Azrael, or you look at the new Fabius Bile limited edition, which has got the mock skin cover, looks like the Necronomicon and things like that, and you just think they look awesome on the shelf. I own a few limited editions myself, not just Black Library, but, you know, other things. Talking of the Necronomicon, I've got the Necronomicon bound copy of The Evil Dead and things, DVD. And they are nice to acquire, you know. It's just a thing, you know, you tend to, I always kind of seem to think of them as, particularly if you're a real fan of it, because actually that's the one that sits on the shelf and it's the one you love, and then you'll get either the ebook or the paperback or whatever to actually read again and again. I've got that with my Lord of the Rings. I've got a fully illustrated copy of the Lord of the Rings with, you know, Alan Lee illustrations and stuff, which I like to look at. I wouldn't actually read that copy.
It's just nice to own. It's nice to be a relic on the shelf, right?
Exactly, yeah. And books, and I think that's one of the things that people never quite get away from, is books have that quality. And particularly when you think it's tied into miniatures gaming, which again is a very tactile, physical hobby. You know, in an age of online gaming and kind of like basically, you know, social media and virtual relationships, actually one of the key selling points of miniatures is they're physical, your opponent's opposite you, you have a conversation and it's ill into the real world. And it's no surprise that I think a slightly higher proportion than maybe in the general populace prefer real books and actually value the physicality of special editions and that kind of presentation.
I know that I'm exactly that same way. I mean, most of my Heresy books I have on the tablet, just because there's not a lot of places that I could go until very, very recently where I could get physical copies of it. So I would always pinch my pennies for the super limited edition character ones, the ones that were like, I need this as much as I need blood in my veins. And having those and kind of having that ritual where you sit down in the chair and you open the book, you smell it, there's the tactile sensory experience with a lamp on and your favorite drink and nice music playing, that there's some nirvana in there. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think so. It's part of, you know, and like you say, you know, there's broader practicality of having an ebook library, which is great. And like I say, you know, you can carry 1,000 books around in your pocket kind of thing. There's also something nice about sitting there and looking at your bookshelf and thinking, these are all mine, and running your fingers along the spines. And, you know, and also I think, I mean, not necessarily stuff that I'd really considered before, but now that we've got a little boy who's just coming up to 3, but I think about when I was little and seeing the shelves of books that were my mum's and dad's when I was growing up and reading some of them and things, and thinking, well, when Sammy gets older, he's going to be looking at all those books. And in fact, he does now, but, you know, most of the books are in our dining room. So he's always pointing up little pictures on the spines and saying, what's the one with the ship on and all that kind of stuff. So he's already interacting with books in a way that you can't do digitally. You know, you don't get digital, you know, as much as he does sort of like watch stuff on YouTube and things. You sit down and you read a book with him on your lap, and that physical relationship's established again. And I think we never kind of get away from that, as much as the practicality and the almost the pragmatism, I suppose, of ebooks. You can't get away from the romance of a real book.
I think you're exactly right. It is really nice to hold just that, those pages in your hand. And like me, I'm very careful with the spine. I've got a certain way that I go about it. It's like a ritual, you know, just to be a part of it and have these and get involved with these characters, you know, that you spend so much time with.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, sort of going back to the Black Library life thing, because obviously people bringing books to sign and stuff, and some of them were very old. So actually some people still had the first printing, the first editions of Angels of Darkness, which is 16 years old now, I think, with the Clint Langley cover, which I don't even actually have a copy of anymore, because I think I gave away the last of my samples or did it in a competition or something. So And you could tell, and some of them were just in pristine condition. You go, and they say, "Oh, I've read this, you know, loads of times." I think it doesn't look like it, not in a bad way, but I was thinking, you've really taken care of that book. And then there's the other one, you know, somebody come in and they've got the Sun, you know, all three volumes of the Sundering, and the backs are all broken in the spine. And I was thinking, you've read these a lot, haven't you?
They carried them everywhere in their backpack. I mean, it's just
yeah. Well, there's one lady who sort of said, I can't remember what book it was now. She said, "Oh, this one travelled with me all over Europe. You know, this kept me company on trains across Europe, you know, over the summer." I was like, "Well, it seems to have survived quite well, you know." So, yeah, it's nice, actually. Again, it's like, it's almost a story outside the story. Each book has got its own little story and your relationship with it.
How do you change gears between, like, these Marines? I mean, you've written about some very just strong-willed, very impactful Marines, but then you've also done a lot of work with the Eldar. A complete different, in my opinion, I guess, shift of consciousness.
Yeah, I suppose. And how I do it, I don't know, I suppose, because they're just different subjects. So you get a different mindset, I suppose, of the sort of stories you're going to write with the Eldar. The thing I've worked on most recently is Jane Zarr, which is the second Phoenix Lords novel, which is very mythic and kind of like the first one, Ashimen. It's split into two. There's two stories within it. There's one which is the story of how she met Ashimen and became the Jane Zarr Phoenix Lord that we sort of know, the Storm of Silence. And then there's another story which, in my head and with the editors, I kind of call the current day story. But in the case of Jane Zarr, the current day story, which is after the fall, still takes place about 200 years before the Horus Heresy. It might even be before, even earlier than then. I think it's probably even before the Great Crusade begins. So, which is still like nearly 1,000 years after the fall. So that's quite a bit of history, but actually it's 10,000 years ago. You know, that's the great thing about writing about the Eldar. They just have this huge expanse of history. And I got to play around a lot with that, I suppose. And the big difference, I guess, the trick with the difficulty or the challenge with Space Marines, I suppose, is finding that line between having individual characters who are interesting to read about, but also understanding that particularly loyalists and kind of Imperial Space Marines are all kind of cast from the same mold slightly within a chapter. You know, they have they're all part of a culture, I guess, is the way you look at it. Whereas the Elder are very much more individualistic. And I suppose you look at the things that make them different. So even though you might be writing about a squad of Dire Avengers, it's not really the Dire Avenger bit that makes them interesting. It's who they are outside of the War Mask. And it's the same with Jane Zarr. Even though she's a Phoenix Lord and is actually this incarnation of mythic vengeance as a Banshee, and very much sort of like an agent of fate, sort of pinballing a lot across the galaxy into various conflicts and things. Actually, because she's the original Jane Zarr, who she was before the fall, she still has that personality. And in fact, you know, potentially has more personality even than a Space Marine does, because she's taken on this mantle of this mythical being, but actually is still herself at its heart. And that journey is quite interesting to describe.
Do the Phoenix Lords still graft on, like, the soul is in the armor or the soul gem, and when a new person finds it or takes on that mantle, is that the way it still works? I believe reading that in some of the early, you know, Eldar codexes and just thinking it was amazing.
Yeah, that's kind of my take on it, is essentially that when a Phoenix Lord dies, when they've sustained enough damage and essentially the armor's broken open and their spirit energy dissipates and they're dormant, essentially, until another Eldar finds them. And then they essentially absorb the energy of that Eldar to resurrect themselves. But that's not that Elder's not resurrected. And actually, it's one of the things I played around with at the end of the Path to the Warrior, without trying to give too much away, but Karandras turns up and interacts with the character there. And for the Eldar whose energy's been taken, it's actually a release because they're not going to get eaten by Slaanesh. It's one of the few peaceful deaths an Eldar can have. Their soul.
That's fascinating.
It disappears. Their soul is absorbed into the Phoenix Lord, doesn't dissipate into the warp to get eaten by Slaanesh and things. So it's kind of a gift in a way. But it's very much of that, you know, that's kind of a thing I built on just the name of it. You know, the Phoenix Lords always rise from the ashes, but it's always the same Phoenix. And very much, I like the literalism of that sometimes. And it differentiates them from the Exarchs. The Exarchs are these gestalt entities of many spirit stones, all inhabiting the same body and armor from the very first Exarch that wore that armor through to the present day one, and they become this kind of sort of like they essentially take on again. I explore this in Path of the Warrior, but you know the elder that ends up wearing it essentially takes on the personality of the first one. But there's this weird amalgam. They're not. It's not like the Phoenix Lord where it's the original spirit. It's actually this creation of lots of spirits who then embody an idea, sort of thing. So they've got the Exarchs end up being far more like automatons in a way, because they're just these high priests of Cain. They don't really have much of a personality outside of that role, because they don't exist out of that side of that role anymore.
They're locked into that battle role, I guess, the war shrine, is it?
Yes, yeah. And I mean, that's part of the one of the things I've been exploring with the Phoenix Lord series. So I kind of started it a bit in Ashen Men and continue it in Jane's Zahr, which is the role of the Phoenix Lords, but also thinking about how Ashen Men's development of the path, because that's what they invented. They didn't just invent kind of like these fighting styles and the Wicked Dojo in the Eye of Terror kind of thing. It was also this way of thinking for the Elder to compartmentalize everything that had destroyed, you know, the kind of excesses that had created Slaanesh. So how to break their minds up into this particular way and kind of siphon off bits of their consciousness to focus on one bit at a time. And then they go out and promulgate this system, I suppose, to the craft worlds. And I got to play around with some bits, again, sort of like talking about sort of like mythic quests and things, but there's just sort of like little asides and things about how Jane's Zahr and some of the other Phoenix Lords tried to take this method to Kamora, you know, and were basically, you know, laughed out of there, and so we're not interested. So they ended up taking it to the craft worlds and things, and found a bit more of a willing ear. But a lot of this, it's still in flux, and that's one of the things, the Jane's Zahr story, which is cool, which is we get to see her. She's basically trying to get to Wulthwei, and there's going to be an Orc War is going to engulf Wulthwei, so she's trying to get there, basically. But essentially, she runs into, there's bits, you know, the Phoenix Lords and the idea of Phoenix Lords isn't necessarily known by all the Eldar. They're so new as this concept. So that, you know, these days we think of, everybody obviously knows who Jane Zahr is and what the Phoenix Lords are, because they've been around for 10,000 years. But they've only been around for a few hundred years. There's craft worlds in far-flung bits of the galaxy who don't even know, they've never been visited by a Phoenix Lord yet. So, and actually the shrines they're setting up are new. A lot of them have still got their first warriors who were taught by them themselves in the shrines and things. And it's very cool to explore those kinds of ideas in the same way that exploring the heresy allows us to sow lots of seeds of things that we later see in the Imperium. Looking at the early stories of the Phoenix Lords is just essentially an excuse to look at the fall and the time after the fall and how they interact with different parts of Eldar society.
That sounds awesome. I've not read this book yet. So, I mean, you really whet my appetite.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I mean, Jane Zahr's out next spring. I don't know if there's, I don't think there's a release date for it yet. It's, I think it's, in fact, I've got the typeset version just to go over now. So even printing and shipping stuff, yeah, in the spring at some point. And I've got, there's an audio, I think it might be in January, maybe February, I can't remember. There's an audio that I wrote originally to come out alongside Ashen Men, but it didn't get recorded then. It's been recorded and has been released in January or February, called The Darker Road, which essentially is a Ashen Men and a very young Eldrad sort of go on an adventure to try and reclaim this lost oracle of the Eldar. And that was fun. And again, playing around with the idea of these mythic cycles and ancient things from before the time of the fall and stuff. So
imagining a very young Eldrad is kind of exciting. You know, like when he shows up in other novels like Fulgrim and stuff, you always just kind of perk up like, oh, what's going on?
Yes, yeah. Well, he's in Jane's Zahr as well. He's quite influential in Jane's Zahr, say, because he's trying to get to Wulthwei. But actually, but it's quite fun because he's not in charge yet. He's not the high farseer of Wulthwei. He's a seer of Wulthwei. And so it's a different way of looking at characters that we think we know very well, and actually just changing the lens a little bit and saying, well, yeah, but, you know, in the same way, yeah, well, it's like looking at Hercules before he joined the Argonauts, you know, or whatever it might be.
Really exciting, man. Thanks a lot for sharing that insight with us. Is there a particular, I guess, time period that you prefer to spend the time in? I mean, I know that you clearly dig these characters that you're writing about, but is there anything that you really enjoy just getting your hands on more than the other?
Yeah, it's kind of cool, particularly with the Eldar stuff, writing about the fall, but different time periods bring with them different themes. So it was quite fun to write the Beast Arises series. So, you know, that's, again, it's set at a different time. It's not the Horus Heresy. It's not the 41st millennium. The role of the Ecclesiarchy, the way space marines are viewed, And kind of like the whole setup of the Imperium and things is just subtly different. And actually changing the time period slightly just gives you a chance to do sort of like thought experiments, you know, what ifs. Well, actually, if I set this in the 40th millennium rather than the 41st millennium, what does that mean? What hasn't been invented or created yet? What hasn't happened? It's before the invasion of the Tyranids. Oh, what does that mean? Yeah. And you can kind of do interesting stuff. Because it's almost like alternate worlds almost. You've got 10,000 years of imperial history. And throughout that, the Imperium's kind of been the Imperium. But actually, there's been various versions of what the Imperium is and the different institutions and their relative power and role and perspectives and things throughout that time. So actually, one of the interesting bits we did with The Beast Arises, and I kind of focused on, and one of the themes of it was the unease with which the idea of the Space Marine chapters reforming as a legion is greeted. You know, sort of like we as outsiders always think, well, why did they always break them into chapters? And it's just ridiculous. You know, the legions were so cool. And you go, yeah, but the legion started the Horus Heresy and almost destroyed the Imperium. And that memory is still fairly stark, even, you know, like 1,500 years later. There's always, you know, so Space Marines have, you know, they're the saviours of mankind and everyone thinks they're great, but also there's still that slight suspicion about, well, they're the guys that almost destroyed everything too. We can't give them too much power. And that's what different time periods do. You know, you can sort of like, there's existing in the background already is the idea at the start of the 41st millennium was this, you know, there's the Makarian Crusade and this huge expansion of the Imperium. And it's actually quite a positive period. You know, it's almost like a, not necessarily quite a second Great Crusade, but one of these sort of like more optimistic periods, for instance. And, you know, 900 chapter masters went to, I can't remember which planet it was, and reavowed their oath to the Imperium and stuff. So you get to couch things in different terms, depending on when you set them.
That's kind of neat. I mean, I know it's probably hard to pick your favorite again. But it's just kind of curious to pick your brain around some of the stuff, if there's anything that you kind of, identified more with right now. And I'm sure that changes over time.
It does. And I think, I mean, one of the things I sort of learned working in the studio, but you sort of get when you write lots of different things is you just find the element of something that you're enthusiastic about. So if you've got to write about Eldar, you work out what it is about Eldar that you think is really cool. And that are the bits you concentrate on and you kind of bring out in the writing or the army list design or whatever it might be. Space Marines, you know, and think, oh, what's the coolest thing? What gets me excited about these guys? That's what I want to write about.
I also think that Eldrad and the Phoenix Lords are really cool.
Well, that helps.
Oh, man, couldn't you give me something a little bit more epic to write about?
We may have talked a little bit about this last time, but I think you originated the Mastodon, like the one of the newest things that's come out from Forge World. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that was cool.
Since you spent some time there at the home office, did they pick your brain about anything else maybe that they're kicking around an idea for a model for that you could tell us about?
No, unfortunately not. There might be some stuff they've stolen. I don't know.
So not that you can tell us, but I just want to know the conversations.
Well, there's not that I know of, unfortunately. Yeah, it used to be, we particularly for the Horus Heresy, we used to have sort of these regular meetings about every 4 months or every 6 months or so with all the authors, but there's too many of us involved now, really, that doesn't happen. And Forge World used to come in and do a bit of a presentation, you know, Alan Bly would bring the latest toy soldiers they've been working on and things like that. But unfortunately, I don't get that anymore. And I've not got an inside track on Forge World anymore, so... Without you have to wait and see, just like everybody else, really.
Oh, drat.
I've been trying to, you know, throw ideas in and say, look, there's a cool thing that I've invented for the Raven Guard or whatever, and see if they notice. But
a lot of Raven Guard stuff, too, in Korax. I mean, that's that guy's a lot more exciting and appealing than I ever thought he was going to be.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I suppose, again, it's another one where you sort of like, I started with the Raven Guard because, well, there was two reasons, really. One, which was, there were a bit of the heresy that nobody was writing about, and because I came on board the heresy not quite at the start, so there were already sort of storylines in motion that Dan was doing and Graham was doing and things, and the Raven Guard were relatively clean in terms of their story didn't really touch anything else particularly, and also just a simple question, which was, how did they get off Istvan? You know, it's like the background was really well, very well established there. They were caught in the massacre, they suffered heavy losses, but they actually escaped, so how did that happen? But the more I kind of played with it and wrote it and did Deliverance Lost and into the sort of like the novellas that make up Korax, then exploring the character brings out more and more ideas about, you know, cool things that you can do with both the Legion, but also ways that you can develop the character and the storyline.
That's pretty neat. If I can change gears for you, again, I know we're jumping all around, and I apologize taking you from one brain space to another, but you also did some work on the Sylvaneth army book. Is that correct?
Well, not on the army book.
Well, itself, the stories inside, the
yes,
the
lore well,
inside.
I did one of the, yes, I did Wrathspring, which was sort of like the keynote story, I suppose, of Elariel, sort of like the return of the Everqueen sort of thing. So it's been set up. I can't remember what the novel was that came before. There was as part of the Realmgate Wars narrative, the opening of the Realm of Life, I suppose, and the reawakening of Elariel. And so the idea was that I was to write a story that was set straight after that, which kind of showed this resurgent war aspect of Elariel, which was really cool, because one of the things was actually because I got sent a bunch of stuff early in terms of documents or you know, PDFs of what was going to be in the there were actually the design studio kind of briefing documents and things which had pictures of the renders for the new miniatures and everything. So I got to see the new Everqueen model, which was just fantastic. And I just saw that and I thought, wow, everyone's just going to lose it at this one.
And they did.
Yeah. And just seeing some of the paint jobs and, you know, sort of share them on Twitter and stuff, but just absolute collector's painter's model. And some of the other stuff as well was just amazing. But it was one of those, the Stormcaster really knew it and they're very cool, but actually I think the Sylvaneth, it really shows Age of Sigmar and some of the design work that's going into it really hitting its stride. So it's kind of new and unique, but also just enough of a nod back to what was there before. And I think we'll see more and more of that as we go along, and kind of like the designers also kind of just become a bit more comfortable about pushing stuff in different ways.
Well, the reason I brought it up is I follow you on Twitter, and I know that you've been playing, at least getting some small games of Age of Sigmar, and I was kind of curious as to what you thought of the new flow of things.
I got an introduction to it from a friend a little while back. It was kind of tricky to judge from that game, because I was just incredibly lucky in some ways, and it kind of turned into a very one-sided quite quickly. So some of the tactical decisions that you have to make with the game in terms of the sequencing of your combats and attacks and things like that, I didn't really come into it because I'd done so much damage after my first combat. I was playing sort of a Flesh Eater Corp versus, or mostly a Flesh Eater Corp versus sort of a Cornate army. And I just got a couple of lucky charges in and lots of attacks with ghouls and things, and then gutted his army really. But it was good fun. It's very different. It's not Warhammer as it was, in terms of the look of it and the way you sort of like you think about maneuvering and things, but actually it's also a very deep game for something that's like covered in four pages of rules. And then sort of like a lot of the detail obviously comes from the war scrolls, and sort of like the battle plans and things. There's a hell of a lot there to kind of get your head round and get into, and all the kind of accusations of it's just a bit simplistic and just wrong, because, you know, and it scales wonderfully. I think that's the other mistake a lot of people make, is like, oh, it's a skirmish game. You go, well, no, it's not. It's a mass battle game that you can also play small scale. And actually the way the rules are written, it scales wonderfully from having a few models to having, you know, 100 models.
That's very encouraging. I'm also inspired by the Sylvaneth stuff, and I'm going to be over the holidays building some models myself of the tree spirits. Yeah. And just beautiful models.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I have to say they were the first ones I saw of the new stuff. You know, the Fire Slayers are cool, the Stormcaster are kind of cool and stuff. But they're the first ones where I thought, I can see myself putting some of these together. I've held off because I've got loads of other hobby projects and things on the go at the moment. I'm still painting my Betrayal at Kalth models. I'm painting them up for the game. So there's Ultramarines and Word Bearers, like just the two factions for the game. I've not painted Space Marines for a long while, so it was kind of just getting back into painting some Space Marines and having some fun with it, really, to play the board game. Really. And then similarly, I got, I bought a copy of Silver Tower, Warhammer Quest Silver Tower, which I had a demo of when I was doing a signing at one of the stores, at the Derby store down the road. And I enjoyed that immensely, so I bought a copy of that.
It is a great game.
Yeah, seeing the change from the old GW, where you were making some of the rules, you were doing some of those things. I imagine you played Hero Quest and stuff back in the day, Warhammer Quest, and seeing how it's evolved. Like, what kind of experience is that for you?
One of the things, well, I'm kind of jealous, I suppose, because one of the things was for me, I mean, one of the very first projects I worked on was the original Warhammer Quest. We spent, when I was assistant games developer, we spent about 3 months playtesting it. So although we had other things we were doing, it was pretty much at least one or two games of that every day, 5 days a week, which was, you know, what a terrible life to lead. and there was lots of things going on, Blood Bowl League, Necromunda, all of these awesome games were being created and was in at the ground floor. But actually that kind of tailed off. And particularly when Lord of the Rings came along and took up, you know, again, an immensely fun game. I really like the strategy battle game, but took up lots of resources. And Games Workshop, that's when they really started to focus just on the idea of the core games of 40K, Warhammer, and the Lord of the Rings. And a lot of the, I think Inquisitor might have been the last of the, what became known as the specialist games. So the scope for doing that kind of design work and doing those kind of fun projects disappeared. And that was one of the, I wouldn't say it was one of the reasons I left, but it was that when I'd been there for 14 years and was essentially rewriting the same arm books I'd written twice before, it definitely contributed to the sense that I'd done all I could, really, and wanted to kind of branch out again. So actually, the fact that they kind of brought back doing a lot of these other games, brought back Warhammer Quest, we've had a couple of games of Gore chosen, which is great fun again. You know, it's just a little nice gladiatorial arena game. It would have been great to flex those creative muscles in that way.
You still get to play a Warhammer World too, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the good thing. I mean, I live 15 minutes away from Warhammer World and the head office and stuff. So the problem is I have... Every time because I've done a couple of signings there now, and there's another store, say the Derby store, which is sort of my local store. But whenever I do a signing there, I end up spending probably more money than I earn on the books sold. So I go in and I buy some paints and I'll get we did one in a town called...
I think I found a new way to fund my hobby.
I spent £125 because I bought Warhammer Quest and Gore Chosen. It's like, well, I had to sell a lot of books. I didn't sell that many books on that day, you know, it's like... So it's the same every time I walk into a store. I mean, I've subscribed to the new White Dwarf, which I've literally not picked up a copy of White Dwarf since I left the studio for 8.5 years ago. I'd seen some, but I'd not bought it. You know, I'd obviously got a free staff copy for all the years I was there, and I've still got all of my collection, but I'd kind of stepped away from it. And then they're relaunching White Dwarf, and it looked really interesting. I thought, yeah, I'm going to back this, actually. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is and get a subscription.
How cool is it, though? I mean, it's yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, it's just it's a huge turnaround, really, I think, in terms of attitude and kind of just part and parcel of it is just, I think, remembering kind of what we used to do. And there's a very much, you know, it's not just a Games Workshop thing, it's society at the moment, and particularly the last couple of years, like everything old is new again, and everyone of a certain age, there's a big nostalgia kick stuff. So we're seeing things like Gene Steeler Cults. For some people, that's absolutely awesome and totally new. And for some of us, it's absolutely awesome because we've been waiting for it for so long.
For 25 years, we finally got it, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, you know, and I do wonder, because there are things that I know certain members of the design studio, particularly, you know, sort of like miniature design and stuff, there's stuff that they've been aching to do for decades, you know, and Jez Goodwin in particular, I suppose, but, you know, things like Gene Steeler Cults, things like Adeptus Mechanicus, stuff that's been in the background for a long while, explored a little bit in the past, but now getting the full treatment, and it makes me really excited for what they're going to do in the future. You know, I'm really hoping they're going to have a really good swing at sort of like the Sisters and the Ecclesiarchy sometime soon, because...
It's been long in the coming.
We did get a spoiler for Agents of the Imperium out of Black Library Live.
Yes, yeah, there was a thing, and there's, because again, that's the other thing, there's the new Warhammer community page thing as well, which has kind of got these little blog posts and teasers. We've got like Traitor Legion supplement and Agents of the Imperium and things, and all of that, and Warhammer TV, what they're doing with that at the moment. It's all just reaching out, you know. I think it's...
I would consider the Ecclesiarchy and the Sisters of Battle as agents of the Imperium. I don't know about anybody else, but I know I would.
Oh, well, they would be, yes. Yeah, I have no idea. I suspect the slightly more commercially minded, cynical side of me thinks, I don't know if they're out there, but it's a very good way of making use of all those assassins that were in the and Death Watch and things like that. I don't know, which were be released in some of the box games recently, but...
Right.
But it's also one of the things we always sort of wrestled with slightly, and people asked about actually when I was there, which was, you know, we did the alien. Sorry, we did the Demon Hunters, and there was the Witch Hunters Codexes, and everyone really asked about the Alien Hunters. And the idea behind the Alien Hunters originally was because it wasn't going to be just one army. It wasn't going to be like the Grey Knights or the Sisters of Battle as a focus, and it wasn't going to be the Death Watch, although they were going to be an element of it. The idea was it was going to be a bit of an Agents of the Imperium type thing in terms of, without knowing what's actually in Agents of the Imperium, but it was going to be, well, actually, you know, it is the Death Watch, it's the Adeptus Arbites, it's, you know, it's the guys that are almost on the front line of any, you know, before the Imperial Guard machine starts cranking in and things, who are the guys who actually are the first line of defence against alien invasion? Because they're the ones that the Inquisition are going to be working with, sort of thing. But we never quite, because there wasn't a central army to hang it on, it never really got that much traction in terms of getting to the management of GW to get behind it, really. But
well, I have to imagine in the past it was a lot more difficult to create the models, to create the content, and I mean, it, like, just doing all the moving parts was probably a little bit more difficult back then than it is now.
Yes, yeah, and just in resource terms as well, just much more limited, much harder-headed decisions, really, in terms of, like, well, if we do this, then we can't do that sort of thing. So absolutely having to, and particularly with plastics resource, which these days, of course, you know, the streets are paved with plastic. but back then, it's like, well, if you make a plastic kit of that, you can't make a plastic kit of this other thing. So, and the core of an army kind of hung on the plastic kits that you were doing. So if you were to, you know, to follow through that idea, go, well, would you do plastic Death Watch, or would you do plastic Arbites, or would you do plastic Inquisition models, or, you know, it's like, which, what would be those kind of the equivalent of the Tactical Space Marine box set that would be on the shelf as the core of the army? And it didn't have that sort of thing. It didn't have that easy answer, really. So it never quite happened.
You've said Arbites twice. I was going to move past the first one, but I've been saying it Arbites.
There's some people say Arbites. And to be honest, it's all called Latin, and nobody even knows how real Latin was spoken. So that was always
I'll take what you say is the canon.
Custodes.
You're way closer.
Yeah, Arbites, Custodes, Astartes. Just to pronounce every letter.
Is that what you go by? Just go with every single letter, and then and that's what's that's the Space Marine way.
Yeah, pretty much. I think
I'll take that. I've said this before. We've continued, you know, kind of talked about how amazed we have been at all the stuff that the company's been doing. But, you know, it's hard to even imagine, like, what's going to be next. What is going to amaze us next? And then we get stuff like the Custodians and the Sisters of Silence. And then, and, you know, like, we're just talking about the Silver Tower. That's still in recent memory and still just an awesome experience. I think still, is it... And do you feel cool just still being attached to it? And because you're doing with the fuel, you're doing what keeps us engaged in the plastic models.
And it's great. Again, the Black Library has sort of had a reversion of philosophy, really. So again, there was a period where, you know, and people, it was obvious to people that most of the releases were tied fairly specifically to main studio releases. The Codex would come out, or a supplement, or whatever, and there would be a novelization of it, essentially, and things like that. And so, although there were things like the Horus Heresy continued and things like that, a lot of it was very tied into what the studio was producing. Whereas actually, it's gone back to the idea that while there is obviously opportunities to tie stuff in and go, "There's this cool thing happening. Do you want to write a novel about it?" There's also very much the attitude that you guys are the writers. You come to us and you say, you pitch ideas. You say, so for example, you know, you could say, "I've got this cool idea. I mean, I really want to do some stuff with knights, or maybe knights and titans or something like that." So, and they're open to that. So although there might not necessarily be a big main range release around knights, you know, there have been obviously some recently, but there might not be another one for years. We don't know. But that doesn't mean that actually there isn't an opportunity to write a cool novel or series of novels focusing on knights, and that's a great place to be in again, I think. So we get, you know, get to play around with ideas that aren't, you know, there's always that link to the tabletop game because that's what the game is and that's what the background is, but actually taking it further and deeper and kind of broader than just what's covered in the codexes and doing cool stuff. So so I've got a whole bunch of cool stuff that I'm looking forward to doing. In fact, the difficulty is choosing what ones I want to do, almost, because there's, I say, you know, when I wrote The Beast Must Die for The Beast Rises, and I got to do some Adeptus Mechanicus stuff, and I had a proper read of the Adeptus Mechanicus, the new army stuff, Adeptus Mechanicus, and actually going back and reading some of the stuff from the Horus Heresy Mechanicum and things like that, and going, ah, actually, these guys are really cool. It'd be great to write some Dex Mechanicum stuff. And like I say, the knights in particular and how they interact with the Forge Worlds and stuff like that. But at the same time, it'd be cool to do some Ecclesiarchy stuff or some Inquisition stuff or some, oh, la, 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 la. You know, it's like suddenly the box has been opened and it's like you can play with any of this stuff again. And you're like, ooh, okay, all right, I've got to choose now. I've got to start focusing on something. So,
what is next for you, if you can tell us?
So Azrael's come out. I'm currently, Jane Zarr's coming out in the spring sort of time. I'm currently writing Lorgar, Bearer of the Word, which is obviously the Lorgar installment for the Primarch series. I'm due to deliver that at the end of next week, actually. I think I'm on time.
That's got to be a tough one. I mean, because right now we have, I think everyone's got their a firm idea of what he's about, and to bring new perspectives, it's got to be tough.
Yeah, well, it's kind of when they sort of first announced the Primarch series and they were talking to the authors and stuff, and I had the conversation with the editors or the phone call sort of thing, and said, so, you know, shall we put you down for the Lion or Korax? And I was like, no, I've written loads about them already. Can I do someone new? I'd really like to, and at the time I said I'd really like to do either Lorgar or Horus. And so we started chatting about Lorgar and what we could do with Lorgar. And I love the idea of faith in the Imperium and religion and playing around with all that kind of stuff. So we've got a really cool story, which essentially there's several framing chapters which are set during the Horus Heresy, basically around the time of Monarchia, and the Legion having to throw off its trappings of worship of the Emperor, and kind of focused on Cor Ferron, really. But the bulk of the story is all about the relationship between Cor Ferron and Lorgar. But it's set on Colchis before the Emperor arrived. So it's basically Lorgar's origin story.
That dude is a – Cor Ferron is a cool character. I really appreciate a lot of the Marines that very early, either they had their birth on Terra and, you know, they've had to assimilate into what a Space Marine becomes and have them kind of be a hanger-on of some other society and how they interact, or the ones that are still such powerful figures that didn't quite take the process, but yet they're still, you know, people of power within this organization.
Yeah, well, it's one of those, to be honest, the Horus Heresy is just replete with sort of like father-son-daddy issue stories. And Cor Ferron and Lorgar is another one of those, really. So it's essentially, it explores basically I wouldn't even say borderline, this abusive relationship between Cor Ferron and Lorgar as his adopted son, really, when I kind of looked at the background. And it was sort of, it's a little bit, as it was portrayed in the old Index of Thighties in particular, it was just a bit packed. It was just a bit, you know, Lorgar was found by Cor Ferron and raised in the priesthood and stuff. So it's a bit more conflict-riven for Lorgar. It's not quite as easy as, oh, he was really good at Bible study and got put in charge. There's a lot more biblical kind of literal time in the wilderness. And I've kind of been looking not just like at Christianity and Jewish messiahs and stuff, but various messianic figures from different mythologies and even kind of in fiction and stuff. So, you know, there's kind of like looking at Paul Atreides and Dune and stuff. So there's elements of that all go into this Lorgar as he's developing from being discovered by Cor Ferron as an infant to and rapidly growing into sort of like the, you know, due to his Primarch physiology, growing into a formidable warrior and sort of like learned scholar and everything else. So, and then how they rise to take control of the Covenant, really, it's the story we're telling. Or rather, how Cor Ferron does and how Lorgar helps him, sort of thing. So, yeah, no, it's really interesting. And the biggest challenge with it is that there are 50,000 words, these novels, and I could write 150,000 words about these guys because I've always liked the word bearers in terms of their thing, and Lorgar in particular. So that's why one of the reasons why I sort of like decided, you know, I'll throw my hat in and see if I throw my name in, see if I can do Lorgar.
It's kind of funny that you mentioned them as a formidable warrior, and yet, you know, sometimes we kind of think about, well, Magnus is a spellcaster. Lorgar is, you know, he's not concerned. Yeah, he's not concerned with battle, but yet they are still Primarchs and capable of making great war.
That's right, exactly. He's considered one of the most physically least able of the 20 or at least the 18 that we know about. And then you forget, you go, yes, but he's still a Primarch and kicks ass. You know, it's like, it's not, he's just not necessarily that interested in it. And that's kind of, it's funny, so a BL Live, somebody was asking, so like, well, you know, how do you write about the different Primarchs, you know, so like all of these warriors? And I sort of replied, well, that's the bit. It's like they are all warriors and they are all generals. But actually, the bit that's interesting is the other bit. So it's Gilliman as the statesman and the architect, or it's you look at their personality rather than what they do. And the interesting thing about Lorgar is, as an orator, as a theologian, as a leader, as a charismatic individual and stuff, that's what makes him interesting. But he is also a warrior and has these physical capabilities far beyond any other mortal. And these things become very apparent, you know, over the course of the story quite quickly. But that's kind of part of the story as well. That, like I said, this essentially the framing chapters are Corferon thinking about the past, really, and coming to a realization at the end that the relationship he thinks he had with Lorgar is very different from the relationship he did have with Lorgar. And hopefully, it's one of those. I want it to be one of those stories. I hope people will read. And they'll get to the end and they'll read sort of like the conclusion and Corferon's conclusion. And I think I need to read that again now, but with that mindset of what Corferon's just realised. And then hopefully they kind of, you almost get two different readings of the story.
That's exciting.
Yeah. And it's good fun just playing around with Primarchs and the stuff they can do. So, and it's very humble. It's a very humble beginnings for a Primarch, actually, deliberately so. I suppose I'm drawn to those sort of aspects. I did the same with Korak, you know, why he appealed to me, I suppose. He wasn't a king or an emperor of worlds and things like that. He was, you know, hidden by prisoners and shuffled around. You know, he was a bit of contraband for a couple of years. You know, shuffled from cell block sort of thing. And Lorgar's the same. It's not like the Lion where he's adopted by the leader of the Order, and it's not like Gilliman where he's, you know, the greatest statesman of the planet takes him as his son. It's like actually Corferon at this time is an outcast priest who takes him under his wing sort of thing, but for his own ends kind of. So it's quite a fun journey that they undergo in terms of the storytelling.
That's awesome. And they've been killing it with these limited edition releases. I know the people that have been picking them up have been very happy with them.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of part of, again, Black Library's dedication to, depending on how long you want to wait, but actually trying to produce as much as they can, as many formats as possible. So there is the limited edition, or if you want to wait, there's just a regular hardback, or there'll be there'll be the large format paperback.
I think they've been rewarding folks. Like if this is what you want to collect, if this is the book for you, then I think they've made it ultimately worth it for you to do that.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's, that's a wider publishing thing as well, really, which is a case of like, especially when you've got ebooks. Ebooks are the new mass market paperback. It's like they're the disposable, ephemeral thing that you pick up, read, and leave. You know, used to leave in the hotel lobby or whatever. You pick up an ebook, you read it. It's not got much presence. So actually, you go the other way, and actually, the print versions have to have a very particular appeal as physical artifacts. And I think that's where Black Library have been very good at identifying that. And also with the audio and all that kind of stuff as well, they're exploring all these avenues. And I know they've got big plans for audios over the next few years and stuff, and I really enjoy writing that. So I'm looking forward to doing more of that kind of stuff as well. But just delivering these stories to people in as many different ways as they can.
You know, Azrael's out now. Is the Darker Road, the Asherman story, is that out where people can get right now?
As I said, no, it's not out yet. I think it's out in January, as far as I know. I'm not 100% sure. I don't think that's quite on the coming soon pages yet. I'm not sure. I've got a couple of Advent stories, so they're doing the Advent stories again. One story a day between 1st December and Christmas. So I've got Yeah, no, and it's good fun to write just these nice little short kind of one-off things. But the two that I've done this year, actually, they're kind of epilogues to Korax, to Wehrgeld, really. So one's called Grey Raven, which follows the fate of the librarian Balthasar Kathiri, who gets sent in the course of Korax, gets sent back to Terra by Korax to essentially answer to Malkador himself, and the whole thing to do with the Edict of Nicaea and stuff. And then the other one is called Valerius, which is about Marcus Valerius, who again, during the events of Korax, gets sent away to what's essentially this huge battle at a system called Beta Garmon, the great slaughter of Beta Garmon, essentially to die. And so there's an audio coming out called Valerius, which essentially is the end cap on, at least the next installment of his story.
Which I think calendar, every year, and I'm sure this year is going to be awesome as well.
Yeah, there's a whole mix of stuff. They've just put it up as again, you know, they were sort of like advertising it yesterday. So, but they were advertising it. So there's Horus Heresy 140,000, Age of Sigmar stories, and Blood Bowl stories.
All in the same calendar, or is it different calendars?
All, so yeah, all in the calendar. I think so. All just a big mix of stuff. Yeah, there's. I've done a Blood Bowl story lately as well. I'm not quite sure. That's not for an advent. That'll be somewhere down the line. But that's quite fun as well.
God, that's neat.
A whole bunch of us got to do some cool stuff for that.
That's cool. Chris, you got anything you want to ask before we get out of here?
No, I mean, there's always 100 things I think of asking about 10 minutes after we finish. But no, I'm just very excited to see the content that's coming out based on your event yesterday. I'm sure we'll see some of the live stuff. I submitted a question or two that they asked for online submission, so maybe I'll get lucky there too.
Well, Gav, thanks again for taking the time with us, and I hope to talk to you again soon in the future.
I'm sure we can. Looking forward to it.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Why is the rum gone?